to another episode of the Draper Dialogues here on the AWF Facebook page and on your trusty podcast feed. I am DJ Draper. It's a new year, 2021. We took some time off after the holidays, but we're excited to be back talking to the superstars of the AWF. And joining me today, our first, or actually second repeat guest, I suppose, Chadwick Wentworth III. Welcome back to the Draper Dialogues. How you doing, my friend? I said that word last time I had you on, and I got in a little trouble. So,
yes,
welcome back, nonetheless.
The pleasure is all yours, and friend is a great overstatement on your part.
I'll take what I can get. Just be sure to check your mailbox for that, perhaps gift certificate to a steakhouse in downtown Minneapolis. It'll have a return address of Elk River, I'm sure.
And if it doesn't show up, I know where you live. So,
well, I don't live in Elk River. But be that as it may, Chadwick Wentworth III, we had you on last summer, after we were really just getting down in the dumps, all of us here across the world, through the coronavirus pandemic. Wrestling had been shut down and still limited number of events happening. But we've noticed that when we had you on last summer, you seemed to close out by talking a big game that you were going to be coming back to the AWF. But we haven't seen you appear yet to compete in the Collision Coliseum in front of our fanless television tapings for our show on 45 TV. So where you have been there, Chadwick?
Well, there is absolutely 100% chance that you will definitely see myself, Chadwick Wentworth III, in an AWF ring in 2021. I will guarantee you that it will happen without a shadow of a doubt. But where have I been? I have been training diligently. This is the honest truth. I have been training harder than I've ever trained before. As you know, that we have talked about this before, in 2018, I went through two back surgeries. And that put me out for a long time. I was on bed rest for 8 months. That's a long time, you know, but I needed it though. And there was a long time before that, you know, for 10 years where I was in excruciating pain. There were times when I was in AWF and I was a heavyweight champion, and I was in an excruciating amount of pain, just walking, talking. But I never complained. I never told anyone about it. And I finally got the problem fixed. And having this time off in the coronavirus pandemic, of not having any wrestling and was still having time for me to train and eat right and work out, gave me time to get back into the shape that I know that I can be in. Right now, I'm in the best shape that I've been in almost 15 years. That's a shoot. Right now I feel better than I have ever remembered myself feeling. I don't remember anything but pain. Right now I feel great. I feel like I'm 100%, more than 100% right now. So I know right now myself that what I'm capable of doing. I'm capable of competing at a very high level, and ready to showcase the people who probably have forgotten about me. I know there's a lot of people who forgot about me, who think that I'm washed up, has been, who just wants to hold on to some past glory.
I didn't say those things.
And whether you did or did not, I mean, I don't have anything to prove because I've done a lot of things that most people will never, ever be able to do. So it's not that I have something to prove. It's just that I know that I have the ability and the work rate to keep up and surpass anybody that's in this, especially in the Minnesota area, that's current right now. Because I can do things that a lot of other people can't do. Because I'm 6'1", I'm 262 pounds. I'm a true heavyweight. You don't see that a lot. I'm a hybrid athlete. I'm not, I'm lean, I have a low body fat percentage. I mean, there's a lot of things that I bring to the table that you just don't see in Minnesota professional wrestling. You might see a guy that's like jacked, like a JDX. Yeah, but he weighs 190 pounds, right? I weigh 262 pounds, right? And he might be able to do this X, Y, and Z move. I can do that move too, but I'm a heavyweight. So I'm not putting him down or saying anything. I'm just saying that I think people have forgotten that I was the original hybrid wrestler in Minnesota. I was the original guy who brought that mix of wrestling with brawling, with high flying, with all this mixture of style of wrestling to Minnesota, right? So, I want to give people a taste of that before I walk away into the sunset. I want people to say, oh yeah, he really is that good. He really is the real deal. And I want people to not have necessarily forgotten, but just to keep my name in their mouth. That's really what I'm trying to do.
Well, let's not forget too, who is also in your corner at ringside when you did achieve that greatness of becoming the AWF heavyweight champion so many years ago.
Yeah, and who was that?
This guy right here.
Myself?
No. In the corner.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you might have like announced my name cool. You might have done some things that was okay, but I mean, I don't know if you necessarily contributed to me doing anything specific or anything. I don't know.
I don't know if we need to revisit all the history of everything to do with that, though there may have been some strings pulled behind the scenes, but we don't need to get into all that. Speaking of history, though, today, we're having you on the show to talk about the month of February. Yes. Here. It's Black History Yep. Month, and you, Chadwick Wentworth III, are one of the, if not the most accomplished professional wrestlers in the state of Minnesota, at least, of African-American
right.
descent.
Right.
So what's this
yes.
Month mean to you as an athlete and as a wrestler?
Well, you know, we could talk for hours, and we don't have that much time. We could talk for hours about the lineage of Black wrestlers and the beginnings and what it meant to us. We can go back Bobo Brazil and Ernie Ladd. We could just name drop those names. But I want to talk about specifically like where I was a young kid and I was watching professional wrestling. I'm watching professional wrestling and being captivated by professional wrestling, seeing my memories of seeing like the promos that Ric Flair was doing on Saturday nights. I was captivated seeing the Four Horsemen, you know, seeing the Legion of Doom, and I'm just like, wow. But what really got me is when you had Ron Simmons and the Natural Butch Reed. That's where I was like, for me personally, that was what solidified for me that it is possible for me to be able to do that when I'm older. As a little kid saying, I can do that when I get older. Because before those two, because they were able to go to the top. They were tag team champions, world champions. They were able to, you know, get past some racial barriers that have been built up in professional wrestling. And if for me as a kid to sit back and say, wow, they're like, you know, they're actually like main eventing, you know, the Clash of Champions. You know, they're getting put over on national TV. So like those two specifically, that was really, you know, what got me to want to be a professional wrestler. And that's why if you really notice and go back and look at it, and anybody can like go back and look at a lot of my matches, you see me doing a lot of their stuff, like a lot of their power moves, a lot of their stuff, the big power slams. And I can tell you a story about that later, but you can, it's that's just me paying homage to them that they're the reason why I'm here right now.
Going back to, for me, 1992, and we do have to mention that we just unfortunately lost Butch Reed, so we want to send our condolences there. But when around fall of 1992 came, I was 8 years old and just getting into my wrestling fandom. I had, you know, some action figures and I watched it, but I was just reaching that age where so understanding what's going on and watching it any second, every minute I could, whether it be WWE or WCW. And then that is when we saw Ron Simmons. They showed the footage of him beating Vader to win the world title. And as an 8 year old, I don't recognize how big of a deal that was for a black wrestler to do. Just the year prior, we saw Kirby Puckett have that Minnesota Twins team on his back, you know, sports hero here. I didn't think anything of it. Right. And how, looking back, that's with the barriers that were there, a pretty significant deal.
It's huge because, you know, for, you know, there were promoters and bookers that were, especially in the South, that didn't want black guys to like go over and win matches and be champions and be the face of their company. So for that to happen, that means someone had to step on and say, we don't care about that. We want to recognize this man for who he is, a black man. We want to say that he's a black man. We want to put him over and we want to make him the champion. We want to make him the face. So that was a major significant step in professional wrestling. I mean, without that, who knows like what could have happened, like where minorities in wrestling would have gone. You know,
because you talk about Southern promoters, and I don't know if we need to necessarily relitigate Bill Watts as a person or as a booker or as a promoter, but
there have been
things said about him. And but, you know, he put Junkyard Dog in a spot, and the quote I think always came from him: he didn't see color, he only saw green. What do you think about maybe that mindset that we hear sometimes from some of the old timers?
Well, you gotta understand, like, you any person with, even if you don't know anything about the business side of professional wrestling, when you saw the reaction that Junkyard Dog got, whether it was in front of 200 people or whether it was in front of 50,000 people, right? He was controlling the crowd better than 99% of the entire world, you know, guys that were in the locker room, unless you can disagree with me and say that's not accurate. You know, he had it. He had the ability to do so little in the wrestling ring because he had so much control over the crowd with everything else that he was doing. Why wouldn't you as a promoter want to use that to your benefit and say, hey, we're going to ride you all the way, right, to the promised land, right? Why wouldn't that's what I would do if I was booking a show. Like, if you had the Junkyard Dog, man, I'm like, hey, we can, you're the most over guy we got, right? If we want to get TV, at that time in that era, we could have like, you know, rolls to the top, but of course, it's the race thing. It's like, well, we really don't want to see a black guy get put over. We don't want to see that guy in that position. There's guys in a locker room that are going to get upset that he's in that spot. So I don't want to deal with that. So, I mean, and
going into 1990 there, we saw Mr. USA, Tony Atlas, who was one of the biggest stars for the same company, 15 years prior or whatever, in one of the stupidest gimmicks and just total appropriation, they had him being Saba Simba. So you had these different mindsets there where the big guys, WWE still was, maybe not forever, but at that time certainly, could just seemingly get away with that, and the stupid Akeem repackage of One Man Gang. Like, how do you reconcile some of all this as we look back
in
history?
You know, they still do today. They still do the same thing today. I mean, and it's sad. And here's one thing, you know, and there's one thing that I talked to my family about. I talked to my parents about this, and my grandmother, who was an avid wrestler. I mean, she watched wrestling from the time that she was younger on a black and white TV. You know, she was watching, you know, God rest her soul. But there was one thing that they said, and it might have been to a little bit of a deficit to my career overall, was that I wasn't going to do the stereotypical black character in wrestling. They were like, we don't want to see you doing that type of character. We don't want you going out there dancing for people. We don't want you going out there acting like a gangster. We don't want you. They didn't want me to do that. And I agreed to that. And I said, I'm not going to do that type of character that is to a detriment to the black culture, to where what the white culture sees black people as a criminal. I'm not gonna go out there and present myself as a criminal because a white person already sees me as that. So I'm not gonna put myself out there as that character. That's one of the reasons why I went completely opposite of that with the Chadwick character.
Right.
The
Gusta Pro Shop, right?
That's one of the reasons why I did that, because even today, WWE, you know, they give these guys characters that, because somebody in the office says, oh, well, that's what a black person is supposed to do. They're supposed to go out there. And I have no issues with a person deciding for themselves that they're willing to do that. I don't have a problem with that. But I wouldn't do that just to get a job. I would not go out there and pretend to be a criminal or pretend to be something else. I just can't do that.
And I think we've seen the most successful have been on the merits as an athlete, like we've seen with you, like we've seen with Ron Simmons, who granted, you know, had a little bit of a character there in the 90s. And I think we can look at go ahead.
I was gonna say when Ron Simmons did the Farouk character, the only thing that I would say, I believe that the first incarnation of Farouk was almost a slap in the face to him, but he himself transformed that into what he thought the character should be. When it transformed into the Nation of Domination, I'm like, man, I want to be in a Nation of Domination, because he was saying the things that I wanted to say when I was out in public. He was mirroring the things that I wanted to say, but I couldn't say. So I felt connected and drawn to him when they were doing the Nation gimmick. That was one of the best things for me as a young black man. That I had seen in a long time. You had DX, you had all these, but okay, so like, where do I fit in? Like, where does Chadwick fit in? And then all of a sudden, here comes Nation of Domination. And I'm like, man, that's me. That's like, I see myself like in that. So that was like probably one of the coolest things I've seen in all of professional wrestling.
Right, just having a little bit of the chip on the shoulder there, but man, not letting it just overcome the entire character.
I mean, have you seen me talk? I mean, you know the chip. I have a boulder on my shoulder when I'm talking. I mean,
So about how difficult it is to break in for black wrestlers, and I don't think this is necessarily exclusive to wrestling. I'm reading a book right now by Dr. David G. Schwartz. It's called At the Sands. It looks at the history of the Sands Casino out in Las Vegas. And they talk about there how Frank Sinatra had an ownership stake. Rack Pat was hanging out there doing two shows a night. And Sammy Davis Jr. was there. And Frank was a big advocate for him, but still the management would not let him hang out in the casino. They wouldn't let him stay overnight. He had to go find a place on the west side of town to stay. But yet you have this entertainer, talented as hell, making this casino all this money, and they still can't look at the guy as a human being. So, and also Dr. Dave, the author, a big wrestling guy, he has written some things for Vegas 7 magazine on Ring of Honor's tapings when they've been out in Vegas and some indie shows, but I digress. Just a shout out there. So what do you see as maybe some either similarities or differences with other forms of entertainment for Black Americans to get really good shots to succeed in pro wrestling?
Well, the problem is fear. There's fear when you see a Black person. Doesn't matter what genre you're in. You could be working in any field anywhere, and you walk into a predominantly white-owned company. There's fear that you're going to lose something. There's fear there that I'm going to lose my position. This person could get hired. So those synapses start firing. And then what am I going to do? Like, how do I handle this? And what do I do? And I'm not going to tell him how to do everything the right way, because that might give him a leg up. Or I can tell you a quick story about myself personally, about when I first started, like my first, you know, few weeks in training camp, breaking into the wrestling business. I signed up, you know, and then went into training camp. No problems. And Austin Aries and I were kind of like partnered up together. So we would do all our chain wrestling. We would do all our bumps together. We would do all this, and we would work out matches together, and we would just work out together. And then they let us go in the ring eventually. So we started doing matches in the ring, right? And then our trainers were like, oh, you guys are great. You guys are this and that and blah, you know. So then all of a sudden I started noticing that.
Which one of you was the next Sean Waltman, though?
Right. No, no.
Sorry.
That none of the other, besides Austin Aries, none of the other people that were training and none of the other vets, because at that time, all the vets came to camp and worked out. There was probably... It's different now, but back then, on a training night, you could have 25 or 30 people there training, working out, doing different things around the ring, in the ring. Yeah, but when I started, I started in April, so it was warm out. So the ring was out in his backyard in the lawn. So there was wrestling mats in the driveway, wrestling mats inside the garage. So there was people everywhere doing different things. And I started noticing that I was people, they weren't talking to me at all. Like, they were not communicating with me. The veterans and the new trainees, whether they had been there for a month, 3 months, 4 months, however long, none of them were talking to me. And I'm talking to Dan talked to me, Austin Aries talked to me. We'd always work on our matches. So after about 3 weeks, I went to one of the vets and I'm like, you know, like, what's going on? Like everyone, every time I go like into an area, everyone like leaves. And I asked him, I'm like, what's going on? He goes, well, you know, everyone is upset that you're doing all these moves with Austin Aries. And I'm like, what does that mean? And he said, you're doing too much. You need to stop doing what you're doing and just do the basics.
Based on what, though?
That's what I'm like, okay. So I'm like, what? He goes, you're only supposed to be doing, you know, the basics, like a lockup, arm drag, you know, just the basic of the basics.
You're 4 months in at this point, right?
Right. So and at that time, Austin Aries and I at camp, we would sit back and we would watch ECW tapes and memorize Eddie Guerrero matches. We would memorize matches. Like, we would just sit back and the Jerry Lynn RVD matches. We would sit back and like look at spots, memorize them, and then we would go do them and do them in the ring.
And those matches, the go home was normally a snapmare or a side headlock, and that's it, right?
Right. So sure enough, that guy was like, "You can't." He goes, "You shouldn't be doing all that stuff." But yet, didn't say anything to Dan. Didn't say anything to Austin Aries. Austin Aries, you didn't tell him like to like lower down his trajectory. But told me, specifically said, stop doing what you're doing. So that kind of gives you an idea of like the mentality of like how like what hurdles I had, like, you know, black wrestlers have to jump over or had to in this business just to even get a shot or a chance.
Yeah, I mean, that's just in training camp. What about when it comes to actually getting bookings getting better spots?
So Austin Aries and I were working or training our way up to our first match. And our first match was at Grumpy's. I don't know if you remember those shows, Grumpy's down
there. I never went to one, but I was familiar. I would read about that in Tim Larson's newsletter and on Chris Dady's website back in the day. But I was pretty much exclusively going to West St. Paul.
Okay.
Kind of where I was at.
So Austin Aries and I do this match, and we're greener than green, but we go out there and we actually have like, and it's on YouTube still, that match that we have. And it's pretty decent actually. We go out there, we do everything top to bottom, right? Crowd is, you know, the 20 people that are there. We get back to the back. And all most of the veterans in the locker room are just chewing our behinds, chewing them, both of us. You guys did everything. You stole the show from us. You know, what are we supposed to do now? We can't go out there. We're going to go out there and the crowd's going to sit on their hands and it's your guys' fault. Like, they blamed us because they couldn't go out there and like work harder than we did. Right. This is the last time you guys are going to do that. And this is a true story. I'm not even joking with you. And I don't want to name drop because I don't want to put them out there like that. But you know who I'm talking about. because some of them are still in the business right now.
Well, that really narrows it down. So we might need to edit that part of it out, or else process of elimination is going to start getting at play here, and we don't know if we want to get anyone in trouble.
No, I don't want to. I'm not going to name drop. But anyway, but that's just you know, there wasn't. But here there was one person, and there was, and this guy, like, there was one person who was there who was booked on a show that said, "Hey, I'm going to help you." Like, with your psychology to maximize what you did, so you don't have to do as much, so it makes sense, and you'll still get over. And I'm like, well, what does that mean? And so it was Lenny Lane. He was the only guy that actually like said, "Hey, I'm gonna come with me. I'm gonna show you what you need to do," because he was still signed with WCW at that time, and he just happened to be there. He was still the Cruiserweight champion, and he was there. He was there that night, and he was like, "Hey, I'm gonna." He goes, "Hey, here, I'll be around every now and then, and I'll help y'all, and I'm gonna watch your matches and tell you what you did good, but I'm gonna tell you what you did bad for sure." And he just was like, you know. And then after he left WCW when it folded, and he was in Minnesota full time, he like totally 100%. You and I are working every show he was on. And I was on. I worked him every time for I don't know however many years. And he taught me how to put a match together, taught me how to put a show together. Like, and he would ask me questions. Why do you think I booked the show this way? Why do you think I put these two guys like on match number two? And I'd be like, I don't know. And he would tell me. And then over time, I started understanding how to book a show, how to put matches together, and it, you know, and then. But he really, for some reason, I don't know why, he just said, "I'm going to teach you how to do everything, kid. I'm going to teach you how to do everything."
And then, so looking back on those times to now, we've certainly seen a culture shift, not just with the number of black talents that we have in wrestling, not just in Minnesota, but elsewhere, but just, I would say, how many potential top guys we have right now. What are some of the folks that you think could just break through to that next level? I mean, we just saw Darius and Dante Martin move on to AEW. I think
absolutely.
JDX has potential there. Are there any others that you potential. Think we should be aware of?
Jossie is really good.
Ah, former guest on this show. How did I forget him?
He has the ability, and he has, I think there's just like a couple puzzle pieces that aren't put in the right positions yet. And once he gets those in the right position, he can make $1 million. I mean, legitimately. But I wish, and I don't know if they're gonna watch this or not. I wish some of those guys that were you know in that I wish they would like just message me or call me and say hey like you know like what could I do to get to that next you know and they probably don't think that I know but I have the blueprint. I have the blueprint. I have the knowledge and the wisdom to say, hey, this is what you need to do. This is what you this is what, instead of saying this in your promo, you should say that. This is what you should be saying in your promo. It was great delivery, but say it like this instead. You know, I could give him and a couple other guys that too, to get them to that next level. You know, giving someone getting information doesn't stop because you're smart. You know what I mean? Like if just because you're smart doesn't mean you stop learning. Just because you have money doesn't mean you don't want more. So like, I don't want those guys to think, well, I already have like all the answers already. There's nothing that you could give me that I already don't know. You know, I want to be able to push those guys and be able to like, you know, elevate them higher than they already are. Like those guys are already up there, but why not go a little bit more? And I could give those guys that, you know, just to, here, do this instead. You know, like, hey, like, what can I do? What can I do to elevate my promo skills? What can I do to elevate my, not even my in-ring, because, you know, in-ring is subjective and you really don't want to get involved with too much with that with guys. But my facial expressions, my, you know, my ring, my psychology, you know, stuff like that is something that I personally got taught from the best of the best by, you know, and that's the only way it happens is when it gets passed down. Right. And I'm ready. Like I have that playbook, and I'm ready to pass that playbook on to the next person.
And you're not just
otherwise
going to be the,
if I'm not,
I was going to say, you're not going to be just the nameless old timer that you mentioned earlier, just saying everything you're doing wrong. You actually want to help give people the tools to get to that next level, which is something that
I
think has always been there in wrestling in general.
Right. No, I'm that's not my position to say, oh, you're a bum. You know, you don't know what you're doing. Get out of the business. You know, that's not me. I know. But, some of the stuff that is the intangible stuff, you just don't know by yourself. If someone doesn't tell you, there's no way that you can know this stuff. If Lenny Lane never told me these 100 things, there's no way that I ever would have thought about it. There's no way. I mean, it's impossible. It literally is impossible.
You only pick up so much from watching other people work, right?
Right,
so,
right. Someone has to tell you, this is what you do. This is how you do it. This is going to, this, X, Y, Z, this ABC, 1, 2, 3. Like you're doing these things well, but this is what you really need to work on. And I think I had the ability to do that, but I would never force it on anybody. I would never just just force myself onto people and say, you need to do this and you need to do that. If someone came and asked me, I'm more than happy. If the, you know, we have a lost art of younger guys asking veterans to watch their matches. We don't see that anymore. We don't see that anymore. And I believe it's out of fear that they don't want to hear anything bad. They don't want to hear anything negative about their matches or about themselves, you know, because why would you want to hear anything bad about yourself? You know,
I've regrettably witnessed that a couple times where someone was giving someone else advice and every criticism, the younger guy who may have been in his fifth match, if that, comes back with the justification for why he did things a certain way. It's got to be just mind-boggling when you're going to take your time and your wisdom to share it with someone and just be crapped on like that.
Right. And it's, you know, again, you know, like this, we can't, wrestling is always evolving. However, the DNA that's intertwined will never change. There's DNA wrapped up in professional wrestling that will never change. Ever. It's always when we are working for AWF TV, there's always a hard cam.
Well, you would always hope everyone recognizes that, however.
But that's what the problem is, right? That's intertwined. That's in the DNA of professional wrestling, right? When there's TV, there's a hard cam, right? So when I'm in there and I'm telling the guy, hey, we got to work hard cam, and they just keep fighting me about it. We get back to the locker room. I'm like, you know, hey, bro, we got to work the hard cam more. And there's like some answer back to why they don't want to work the hard cam.
God,
there's, you know what I mean? It's like you can't evolve from working TV. You can't evolve from that. There's no changing that. There's no changing the fact that we have to show our faces at some point in time during a rest spot to the camera. That's just professional wrestling and how it works.
And then, so we talked about the newer, larger crop of black talent. What about the culture specifically? You mentioned that when you were training, you ran into some roadblocks. How have things gotten better in wrestling, and what do you still think needs to improve equity-wise?
Well, for the longest time in Minnesota, a number of years, on the major professional wrestling independent scene in Minnesota, I mean the major promotions, talking about AWF, Steel Domain, MIW. Who else would you name?
Forget FLWA now.
FLWA, of course not. You mentioned those, and there's a couple more in there that we don't have to name. I was the only black wrestler in the promotion that was contracted by those promotions for a number of years. So, having to go through that, having to be booked, especially for some of the AWF shows where the shows were 3 or 4 hours away from the Twin Cities, and you're out in a rural area, and you're
seen some of those bumper stickers sometimes on those cars in the parking lot. I remember,
right? And for a large portion of the time that I was in the AWF, I was a babyface, and as a babyface, hearing the N-word being launched at me in some of those towns, not knowing how to respond as I'm supposed to be in character with a smile on, you know, as being a baby face. And I'm trying not to like break character, and I'm trying to be, you know, right. I mean, like, so having to go through that and having to go through and then having to deal with, you know, friends of mine or even family members saying, well, you should have did this and you should have did that. And why didn't you go beat that guy up? And why didn't you, you know, you're not helping the black culture by defending yourself when they do that. And you know, so not only was I getting it from the negativity from the person launching that, I'm getting it from the other side.
Impossible situation.
Right. So it's being bombarded on both sides and trying to walk that line and stay professional and do my job, but also have to go back home and talk to people and then do it again the next week. We were going every week. We were going every week, 3 hours this way, 4 hours that way, 5 hours that way, every week. And the same thing. And on top of that, there's no one in the locker room I can talk to. Who do I talk to in the locker room about this?
I can think of a couple of guys back then you wouldn't want to, but we don't need to.
Right, no. There's nobody who can say, I understand, because they, you know, I'm by myself, you know. I had friends at that time, but you know, do they, you know, yes, they would have, if anything would have happened, yes, they would have had my back if something were to go down, but that's not what I'm talking about. It's more of the emotional side of it. The mental side, the emotional side of being able to go talk to somebody and that understands like where you're coming from. And today's group, they can actually go to somebody in the locker room, pull them aside and say, hey, this just happened to me out in the ring, or this happened to me in a parking lot on the way inside the building. Look, can I talk to you for 5 minutes about it? So there's more opportunity, and I'm so thankful for that, for those guys to be able to go to have that opportunity to not be the only black or brown or Asian or, you know, Pacific Islander, or we can go down the list, you know, in today's locker rooms. It's more diverse, it's more accepting, and they have the ability to see someone that looks like them sitting across the locker room from them.
That have that solidarity has to be huge.
It's huge. It totally is.
So where do we go from here? Is my next sort of question on this. And I want to preface this by, I watched the Super Bowl recently in the pregame, and James Brown of CBS was highlighting some of the NFL's efforts over the last year, and the fact there are so many players, nearly almost unanimously are black, the major stars in the NFL. Meanwhile, you have one president, you have handful of coaches even interviewed for jobs. In wrestling, we don't see anyone in leadership roles necessarily. We don't see promoters that are black. How do we fix that?
That's
And of course, this is unfortunate, me asking you, the black man, how we fix these problems right, that are right, affecting you
right,
and other black people for so long. So right, just throwing that out there.
It's, I believe, the owner of AWF when I was working there, he gave me the opportunity to do things and to learn things that I never thought were possible in the wrestling business. He gave me the opportunity to learn TV, the behind the scenes TV, which is something that I've always 100% been interested in. And I've always been interested in the production value of wrestling TV. Producing backstage segments, the times that you need for segments, the in-ring times for matches, the production value for producing a wrestling TV show. Right. He let me learn on the job how to do that, and I think it's going to take more owners to give those black wrestlers, men and women, opportunities like that. So that way, if they ever decide to do their own thing, then they have the tools and the skills necessary to run their own promotion. But it has to be passed down. If they don't pass down information, the owners and the promoters don't pass on information, then it's never going to happen.
Winding things down here a bit, earlier you mentioned the Ron Simmons Power Slam, and you said there's a story there.
Yeah.
How about it?
So, in 2015, I think it was 15, maybe 14, I was still doing the extra circuit for WWE. So going from St. Paul or Minneapolis to Green Bay to Milwaukee. It's that three, either or, how that, you know, because they would do Monday Night Raw, and then the next night they either go to Green Bay or they go to Milwaukee to tape SmackDown. That was always the circuit. And the night that we were in Minneapolis, Ron Simmons was just happened to he came in, and I was working a match with somebody, doing a match. And I was doing a tryout match.
Like in the afternoon, sort of, or?
This was probably, match. I had to check in at 11 a.m. So this was probably at like.
I don't know how much folks know about what goes into a day at TV.
Okay. You want me to start there?
Sure. Yeah, that might be
okay. So you have to, this is not 2021. So I'm gonna say this. Oh, that's not how it works. And people are gonna be like, eh, no.
Old timer out of touch.
In, no, put him in the home. No, you're wrong. That's not what we do now. You're gonna have all like the younger guys. I've been there five times. That's not what we do. No, this is 6 years ago. So everyone, calm down. This is 6 years ago. I have to check in at 11 a.m. I have to go and then. I'm prefacing. Then I had to go check in with Carano. Mark Carano. He's like a talent guy there, and he would say, "Yes, you're on the list. You get to go. Like, put your bags in and whatever. If you weren't on the list, they would just kick you out. Nope, you're not supposed to be here today." There's another story behind that too.
That's a bummer.
so I go in. Then okay, yeah, you guys, the lunch is being served. And you guys can eat. Then it's open for the next hour. So you go in there, you just eat because they had the best catering ever, the best food ever. So you get done eating, and then okay, you guys have 5 minutes to get into the ring. It's probably about like 1 o'clock. You guys got like 5 minutes to get dressed and get in the ring. So everyone's like hustling, and I run down to the ring. Literally run down to the ring. I'm the first one there, and Jamie Noble was like, "All right, lock up with me." So I lock up with Jamie Noble. He's like, "All right, you're good." I'm like, oh, okay. So then everyone else comes down,
and yeah,
he's
one
like,
shot.
"Oh, you're the no." He's literally telling people, "No, you suck." Oh. see, I'm dead serious.
Now, do you want to start name dropping?
No. So then, all right, you two work a match. So we're going to work a match. And I'm working. And I call for a power slam, right? So I do it. Boom. And all of a sudden I hear in a super deep voice, he goes, "Stop." And I'm like, no. I freeze. And I'm like literally freeze. And he was like, I look over and it was Ron Simmons. Right. So we stopped, we ended the match, and I go over there like in the corner in the ring. He goes, "You can't do the power slam like that." I'm like, "Well, that's why I've been doing it forever, because I thought that that's the way he did it." He goes, "That's not how I do it." And he told me how I'm supposed to do it. And I'm like, "Oh yeah, that makes, you know, like duh, that makes sense." Like how he explained it to me. I don't know why I'm just copying him off of TV, but he says the way he does it and explain it to me and why it's safer and it's easier for the guy to take that way. And I'm like, "Oh, okay, that makes sense." So then me and the other guy we do the dark match. I do the dark match that night. So I'm talking to the other guy I'm doing a dark match against, and we got to work against two like WWE guys. And the guy doing the other guy that the other indie guy says, "Hey, dude, you should do the Ron Simmons Power Slam." Oh, no. And I'm like, "Heck no, I'm not doing that." And he's like trying to like get me to do it, and I'm like, "No, dude, because if I mess up, he's gonna like rip my head off, like legit, like I mean, like he will for real, like probably beat me up in like the back because I did his Power Slam wrong." So I'm like sweating bullets like the whole like time, like I'm like that's all I'm thinking about back there, right? I go out and do the match, and I can see my partner is like, "Dude, do it, do it, do it." And I'm like, "No, I can't." So I didn't do it. I chickened out. I couldn't do it. That's probably one of my biggest regrets that I didn't really? That I didn't do it. If it was today, I would do it for sure. But back then, I don't know why. I just chickened out. I just dropped the ball, and I was afraid to do it just because I didn't want to make him. I didn't want to let him down. You know what I mean?
Seems to like be I didn't have a chance. More of a ask for forgiveness than permission era when it comes to this stuff in general.
It's different though because it's not like I was doing like some like high spot where it's you know like where I'm trying to get a job or something like that. You know what I mean? The reason why because I didn't have a chance to do it again and practice it. He just told me, "Hey, this is how you do it. This is how you really do it." So I didn't have a chance to go back out and do it. Okay, I'm gonna practice a couple times and do it. Boom. So I didn't want to like totally like mess it up, botch it while he's back in the group position saying, "Dude, are you really? I just told you how to do it like 2 hours ago. Like, are you stupid? Like, do you not know what you're doing?" You know.
From the former All-American at Florida State to WCW World Champion to wearing that goofy ass gladiator mask to teaching you how to do the power slam right.
That's right.
Amazing trajectory there.
But I know how to do it though. Now it's like I've been doing it and it works exactly the way he says it should work.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap things up here with Chadwick Wentworth III. Earlier on, just in that last segue there, you mentioned catering and the subject of food came up on social media this week with Jason DeRussia at Channel 4 put out his list of the top pizza joints in the Twin Cities area, and I want to take a second to maybe get your thoughts on some of these, and if you have others in your neck of the woods maybe that are not on this list.
All right, let's go.
Oh, you go.
You want me to get my list?
Did you not get my DM with the link to this very thing?
I'm
show production meeting.
Okay. No, I didn't look at the list. I didn't look at it.
Okay, so let's just go ahead. Let's hear it.
How about you tell me what his list was and I'll tell you how bad it is.
Okay, so I will say from he's got some various categories here, including bar style. I would say of that list, I still think Red Savoy is, the original one there on East 7th is no longer with us, but up here in Hugo, we have a good one. And I got to say, I still love Mama's Pizza on Rice Street there. Can you disagree with either of those?
Pizza doesn't have to be difficult. Pizza should be simple. Very simple. Doesn't have to be articulate and like, you know, it doesn't have to be like some, you know, like specialty that you see on Food Network, you know, like that costs $8,000 to make. My number one, if I eat pizza, which I don't eat a lot of pizza, trying to stay in shape.
I hear you.
If I eat pizza, I eat Topper's pizza.
Toppers.
Gotta go with Toppers.
Yeah, not on old Jason's list here.
Yeah, no, that's where to go.
The slice category as the one there, Cassettas, which in our last episode of this, we had Tony DiNucci
bad.
Allegedly was blackballed from Cassettas because he was hanging out with WWE guys in the mid-90s as he was doing dark matches. And The Rock at the time threw a fit over mushrooms being on the pizza. Now, we haven't reached out to The Rock to get his side of the story here, or just Rocky Maivia, I think, at that time. Do you have thoughts on this assertion?
Speaking of Tony,
you know he's not going to watch this, so you can say whatever the hell you want.
This is a legitimate question, and I'm not even joking. This is a legitimate question. How... I am dead serious when I say this. that I have never been beaten for the AWF heavyweight title. Ever. No one's ever pinned my shoulders to the mat, ever, for that title. And I've never been given a reason why.
We could probably have a whole episode of our 45 TV show recapping that saga from back in 2014, where you got screwed out of the title the one time. You had the opportunity to get it back. I think it was for Mr. Parks, was it? And you had the title just ripped out from you by Tony DiNucci himself in the locker room.
I understand that. But what I'm saying though is what kind of cheap, dirty soap opera is that? This is professional wrestling, though. The belt has to be
professional wrestling has never been compared to a cheap, dirty soap opera in any context.
It's not
anywhere, ever, and certainly not on the internet.
Everything you just said sounds like a cheap, dirty soap opera. It doesn't even sound like it's like an athletic competition. To me, it doesn't, at least. That's a serious legit. And here's the thing about it is, I'm not saying that it should just be handed over to me. I would never say that. I would never say that it should just be given back to me. I mean, which I would accept. But I'm just saying that shouldn't I be, given like a golden ticket? I mean, I'm just saying I should be given a golden ticket that I can use whenever I want to. At a chance.
Well, we have our new AWF champion here, Kyle Pro. Do you have any words for him? And the program, along with
Stonehenge. I thought this was supposed to be the heavyweight championship, not the cruiserweight championship.
Look at the guy.
How much does he weigh?
I think 210.
He does not weigh over. What's the heavyweight limit? Minimum. What's the heavyweight minimum? It's 226. Or am I wrong? So you know all the rules, DJ. You know the rule book.
I haven't had a minimum to compete as a heavyweight in professional wrestling since probably the 1940s, if not earlier.
I want you to look at me.
You are starting to sound like that old timer, that caricature that you were just complaining about earlier in this interview.
But here's what I want you to do. Okay, tell me that I'm wrong. That there's supposed to be a weight limit in professional wrestling.
Not for the heavyweight limit, because you can go up a weight class. It's the cruiserweight or light heavyweight or
I can't go down, but they can go up, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yes, because they have a disadvantage due to size. Of course they can go up.
Okay. So this 180-pound guy, who is it, CalPro?
CalPro, yes.
Is the heavyweight champion. That doesn't even sound right to me.
He defeated JDX in that high five challenge. Shoulders were down. Brandon Gore got the showing the tape here right now. Brandon Gore hit that rolling German suplex, and Kyle floated over to steal it. There you go. It's done.
Okay. Here's what I'm gonna say. At some point in time, I'm gonna be back in the AWF, and it may be all like fun and giggles, or we're cracking jokes right now, but on a serious note, I'm coming back. And you might roll your eyes, and you might say that, whatever you're gonna say.
Are you gonna call for a commission to return now, so we can have strict weight limits enforced?
If you have these little baby-sized cruiserweights running around, and I have to wrestle them in actual matches, they might get hurt.
Kyle Pro isn't a baby cruiserweight. Come on, look at some of the other talent we have here. You know, we got Angel Dorado, who's at least 50 pounds less. He's now one half of a awesome tag team in AEW. So I don't get where you're coming from.
What does that mean? You get where I'm coming from.
It means he held the AWF TV title, and there's no weight restrictions there.
You know better than anybody the style of wrestling that I'm bringing, and nobody in AWF has seen anything like it, and you can't deny that. So I know you're playing coy right now, which is fine. But only thing I'm going to tell you is this, and everybody who's watching this, and all these morons who are chuckling at home and thinking that it's a joke and they're laughing. Chadwick went with the third. It's coming there. Oh, and you know who else I got something for? I got a big issue with this dude. Downtown Petey Brown.
He's gonna watch this, so
Downtown Petey Brown. And I'm saving the best for last. Cal Pro, whatever your name is, I don't even know. Whatever.
You serious?
But Downtown Petey Brown, you are the one that I got.
Who's
a laser.
Our television champion, by the way.
I got a laser focus. I got laser, and I mean laser focus. You are number one at the top of the list, bro. I'm coming directly for you, and there ain't nothing, and I mean nothing, that anybody can do to stop me from coming after you and ripping that your stinking little peanut-sized head off of your shoulders. And I'm going to stick my fist down the gaping hole that I leave and pull your guts out and wrap them around your stinking little body and flex you like a yo-yo. You understand what I'm saying to you, chump?
Did he beat you in a game of Madden or something? What's going on with this intensity toward Petey?
He knows, and I know, and he knows that his days are numbered. His days are numbered, legitimately numbered. I'm at 100%. I am back. I am 100%. And anybody, I'm steamrolling. And it ain't nothing that nobody can do to stop me. Nothing. My name is Chadwick Wentworth III. I was, always will be, three times better than you.
All right, since we're ending things there on such an uplifting note, anything you want to plug, merchandise, social media, etc., before we let you go?
No, I don't want none of these morons doing anything with me on social media. Anything, nothing. Don't follow me. Don't look up none of my stuff. Nothing.
Well, that's different.
You'll see me at a show. you'll know what's up. You'll know what's up.
Well, nevertheless, thank you for joining us here today on the Draper Dialogues. It's always a great pleasure. And that's gonna do it.
Yeah.
Chadwick Wentworth III. For coming back to join us here on The Dialogues, and we hope you enjoyed it. Of course, be sure to check out the AWF on 45 TV every single Saturday, 12 o'clock noon. Don't miss it. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube page, like us here on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Again, can't wait to see you in a live AWF crowd again soon. It's important to just keep doing all those precautions. Wear that mask around other folks. Get tested if you're feeling sick. Stay home if you're feeling sick. And when it's your turn, get that vaccine. That's how we're going to overcome this. We're going to have AWF action again very soon, hopefully in front of raucous, numerous, huge, massive live crowds. Thanks for joining us. Catch you next time here on the Draper Dialogue. So long, everyone.